This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson. Joining me are Brock Rahm.
There's nothing funny about media asset management and data integrity.
And Garrett Wright.
I don't really have anything funny today. I'm just not funny.
Everyone deals with maintenance and storage when it comes to footage. We're joined today by Matt Tape of the Houston Rockets to talk through different ways to approach storage and archive. Doesn't matter how small or large your team is, search and discovery is an important conversation.
Are you guys recording?
All right.
Hey, what's going on? It's Justin. Just wanted to give a shout out to APM for providing the track for us here on the Creative Sports Podcast. We're doing this podcast as an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're finding us and aren't a member of the community yet, you can sign up for free at sportscreativeslack.com. All right, so our conversation today is going to surround asset management, and we've brought Matt Tape from the Houston Rockets into this conversation to explore a couple different things, partly equipment and getting into metadata and leveraging content and infrastructure for future content and LTO and cloud. And we'll kind of walk through some of this and explore how we can, you know, the importance of asset management from the start and get a little bit more complex as we go along here, because I know there's quite a few people who actually still use external drives as their primary source. So we'll start simple and try and talk through how to log and name clips up front if you're using a basic system, and then what next steps can be. So Tape, appreciate you joining us, and excited to get this conversation going. Can you just start by giving people a little bit of a background of what you do with the Rockets and how you got into the position that you're in right now?
Yeah, what's up, everybody? What we do at the Rockets, that's very tough to explain because we do a little bit of everything. Game ops, IT, production, post-production, live production, scripting, help pick out the dancers every now and then, work with the mascots, work a lot with technology in the building. It's a pretty fun job, not going to lie. How I got where I am, I started off as an intern in 2007. Basically, I procrastinated my whole college career. I didn't even choose my major until I had no other classes to take, basically. My advisor told me I have to choose a major in order to, you know, continue going to college. So I went around. My GPA was only high enough to get into a couple of schools within my school. And I basically played eeny, meeny, miny, moe with a whole bunch of packets. You know, I went around to every college, saw what they had to offer. And at the end of that night, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And media production just sounded interesting. It was funny because my roommate at the time, he was in his senior year. And when he found out I picked my major, he changed his major for like the second time his senior year. And his parents weren't too happy about that. But yeah, so I started off as an intern. There was no job for me at the time. It was after I was done. I hopped around. I worked for a bodybuilding company doing media, not actually lifting and, you know, pumping weights myself. Went to things like the Arnold Classic and got to meet Schwarzenegger and stuff like that. So that was pretty cool. Worked for a tennis company for a little while before the Rockets, had a full-time job and offered that job to me. So I started off as a video coordinator, and, you know, fast forward 10 years, my title is now Director of Broadcast and Video Production.
I think one of my favorite things and why I wanted to have you on this episode specifically is that you come from the school that I think both Justin and I kind of did too, which is like, if you don't know it, you figure it out yourself and you learn how to do it and you're better for it. What was that like starting at the Rockets? Where were they at, you know, from a tech perspective, from a production perspective, and what were some, you know, I don't want to say challenges, but what were some opportunities you really got to explore and learn and grow from at the Rockets early on?
Sure. So I guess when I interned in 2007, you know, the popular camera at the time was the P200s or HVX200.
The 200s, and then there were the 2000 and 3000s were the big shoulder mount ones. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So, you know, they had just upgraded to shooting on P2 cards. We were coming off the DVX 100 or 100A or B or whatever the heck the mini DV version was from Panasonic. Our editing system, there was no such thing as shared storage, at least for us. We were on Avid, but on those iSCSI drives. I don't know if you remember, but it was basically a little RAID 1 with a parallel printer port looking thing going to each drive. And those things sounded like airplanes in the edit room.
Oh, yeah. This was back when you used to have, back before Avid and DigiDesign merged, and you had to have your hardware in a rack next to you dongled, all your IO was there. That's where you had to hook up your tape deck. That's where your storage was, all in the edit suite with you.
Yep, exactly right. And then, so those Avid iSCSI drives, they were expensive. We had two edit suites at the time, one in each little area. We have two little rooms that we kind of cram everybody into. And you know, you can't expand the storage on that. And they always, for whatever reason, striped them in RAID 1 to get the most speed. So whenever we lost a drive, we lost everything in that edit suite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's dive into RAID, because I think that's probably something that people might not be familiar with and the different types of RAID. So what you're talking about is that everything was just singular on that drive, right? And different types of RAID configurations allow for mirroring and striping so that you can have some backup options if a part of the drive fails. Do you want to dive into that a little bit more?
Sure. I guess, you know, RAID 1 is basically, let's say, for example, you have four or five drives. That file is split equally amongst those four drives. And that way that gives you the fastest read and write speed. Let's say you went to a RAID 5 that gives you a spare. So if a drive were to fail, you can pull that drive out, replace it, and it starts rebuilding. You have some degraded speeds, but you're still up and running. So you do have some type of backup. And RAID 6 is basically two spares. At the time, RAID 1 was the more popular option because it gave you the fastest speed. But if you lost one drive, you lost everything you owned, which probably happened three or four times to us, to be honest. And every time it'd be, you know, in the middle of some project that was super important, and we would just kill ourselves, you know, because we just lost everything we had on that edit suite. And I mean, the biggest thing was once you got to those to P2 cards, everything started going digital. Before, all of your shoots were on, you know, mini DV, and there was a backup. Like if you lost something, you could always just recapture it. But with P2, you're like, hey, that's now on a digital storage medium. So you have to kind of, there's no backup unless you're backing it up actively.
And that's a big part of that is because of the card cost and reformatting the card, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Those things were expensive. I think they were SD cards in there, Brock?
Oh, yeah.
And they just sold them for like thousands of dollars.
Yeah, they were either SD cards or compact flash cards, and they literally just repinned them out in like a random different configuration and made it and put a little bit of like lock and key encryption on there that it was ridiculous.
Oh yeah, you had to have there was certain software I think you had to buy just to read some of that stuff. But what we ended up doing is like probably what everyone else did for more storage. We added external hard drives. And at the time, it got so bad to the point where I just called them dominoes, because they would be lined up on our desk and we had like eight additional drives. And I remember one time we accidentally knocked them over and they literally all fell like dominoes.
I think people coming from a tape world, and I know I'm not that old. I know none of us are that old, but I originally shot on Betacam SP, and back in the Betacam SP days, you'd shoot a tape, you'd go through it and you'd log it with time code on a piece of paper. You'd put that in there with the tape and you'd put it on a shelf. I think when that transition from tape to digital happened, I think a lot of the mentality was like, oh, well, we'll just buy hard drives and hard drives are our tapes and we'll just hand log them and put them on a shelf. And I remember, Because RAIDs, like you said, were prohibitively expensive too back then. So I think people are like, okay, external drives, one by one, this is going to be the way we do it. And it's going to be just like tapes and we're going to put it on a shelf. Well, first of all, hard drives don't quite have the shelf life tape has. And on top of that, I think one of my favorite innovations in the past like 10 years, not just in this industry, but in data across the board, is how much cheaper A, storage has got. It's always bigger and always cheaper. And B, software RAID has made things exponentially easier and cheaper. I was actually just working with a client the other day where we were putting in 150 terabyte NAS, just nothing crazy, just off the shelf bought like from a company like QNAP or something. And I was shocked at how cheap it was. I was just absolutely floored, because when I was at the Chiefs, we went to go add, we were Quantum Store Next, and adding 80 terabytes was like tens of thousands of dollars. Now granted, they're doing more. There's metadata controllers. There's a lot more to that system. But still, in the grand scheme of things, one of my favorite things is how much cheaper storage has got. But also, back then you had to put yourself in the perspective of like those little external hard drives were sometimes $500, $600,000, a piece. And then if you wanted to RAID something together internally on like you said, SCSI drives were not cheap either. It was a scale of economy that hadn't quite caught up for the amount of data video was doing yet.
Oh yeah. When those things were spinning at 10,000 RPMs or whatever they were, like literally you could hear it start spinning up in
the Raptor set. Drives.
Yeah. And at the time, just for those of you in live production and remember, we started off with Vplays. So in order to load content, you literally, someone in one room would, like you said, they'd have to hit play from a tape deck, and the other person in the room on the computer to load clips would have to hit record. Because there was no shared storage or anything like that. It wasn't until VNets came up that people started just importing files versus recording them. But yeah, so the first thing we did after so many failed drives and losing so much footage that is unrecoverable and will never get back, like we used to play jokes because we'd have so many dead drives. My old boss at the time, Joe Abercrombie, he would just carry this hard drive around that we lost during one of our projects. And the big joke was he would just start walking in the hallways and, tell people, hey, here's our intro video. It's here. I got it. It's done. This is the only place. And then he'd drop it like down a stairwell or something in front of people and, just watch their face kind of in terror, I guess. But yeah, after so many failed drives, we ended up buying our first RAID set. It still wasn't shared storage, but it could do RAID 5. And we did that for about a season. I think it was like a GTEC drive at the time. And then after that, we actually got traditional shared storage. We got an Isilon at the time. So that was a big deal for us. I think we got 30 terabytes. And at the end of that day, we were high-fiving and, you know, dancing and, you know.
And that probably got you through a season.
What's up?
That probably got you through a season, maybe a season and a half.
It actually got us through a couple seasons. So we actually got two different types of shared storage at the time. We got an Avid. This is their when ISIS kind of not first came out, but was first, I guess, affordable to us. So we had some stuff specifically for Avid, and then we had just a generic shared storage just that we could hold clips and all this other stuff.
So you've both mentioned different types of storage there. I think it probably makes sense for us to get into a little bit about NAS, SAN, and different types of storage options, and help everybody understand what you're ultimately trying to do. I know there's quite a few people, if you log on to a server and IT sets it up, and they, if you're on a PC and they set it to like the L drive, that's what people take to calling it. But generally what people are looking at is you are connecting to a storage that has a dedicated IP address that you're accessing, right? Can we dive into a little bit more about different types of storage?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't know if I'm the best person to talk about this, but like, I guess in simple terms, NAS is like network attached mm-hmm. storage. What it looks like is exactly what you said. When you mount the drive, you can assign a letter to it, but it shows up under network attached storage. And a SAN
basically is fiber channel, right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's fiber channel, but it looks like it's local. Right. And I guess that's the primary difference.
And really, they're becoming really, it used to be if you wanted speed, SAN was the way to go, because Ethernet over fiber wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now. So if you wanted speed, it's like, oh, I want 10 gig fiber, 8 gig fiber, whatever the time was. SAN was really the only way to do that with a fiber channel. Whereas now it's so ubiquitous to send Ethernet over fiber. You know, you can have a very robust 10 gig, 25 gig, 40 gig, 100 gig, whatever you want, NAS, you know, drive as well, as long as you have the infrastructure built out for it.
Yeah, no, exactly. Our first system, we were just on 1 gig Ethernet. Basically, your typical switch going regular, you know, Cat5, Cat5e, Cat6 to the computer. And then you have your storage that plugs into that switch. And this was before people started shooting 4K and all that other stuff. So stuff was still 720p, 1080p, 1080i, that type of thing. We then upgraded to 10 gig Ethernet. Ended up installing 10 gig Ethernet cards in everyone's computers. And
were you guys copper RJ45 10 gig, yeah, like Cat6A?
Yeah, exactly. For 10 gig, we were SFPs, but when we were 1 gig, it was just...
I gotcha.
Standard, whatever's in your computer when you buy it. And then now we do have a 16 gig fiber channel as well with that 10 gig Ethernet as backup.
That's great. Yeah, you mentioned so the speeds there, which I think is really important for people to understand, because... especially getting into 4K, and maybe we can talk a little bit about equipment, what you guys shoot, because that does determine, you know, some of these issues that you could run into with space, you know, different types of formats that you're shooting. If you're shooting in 4K, it's going to, at a certain bit rate, it's going to cost you a lot more space and storage, right? So I guess if you want to dive into a little bit more about what you guys shoot on and how you go about thinking through what's, you know, what file size formats and all that kind of stuff that you shoot on because of your storage backend.
Yeah. So I guess if you have like a 1 gig Ethernet and it's hosted by IT and IT is on like a different level of your building, or they're kind of far away and it goes through a lot of switches, the standard network speeds that we were seeing is probably close to 20 megabits or megabytes per second transfer rate. If you had a faster 1 gig network, you'd probably see like 70. Once we upgraded to 10 gig Ethernet, which was over fiber, we started seeing that rate jump up to like 400s, 500s. And once we've got to 16 gig fiber channel, we started seeing transfer rates in the 700s, 800s, maybe even 900s. So if you're coming back from a shoot, like that difference is when you're copying files to your storage, you know, what used to say 7 hours, you're now seeing in like 7 minutes type of thing. So it was a huge time save. And if you're editing on a timeline, that's the difference between like a choppy looking timeline versus something that can play back pretty smooth, even in 4K, 5K, 6K.
So you guys get your RAID storage, you're using more and more, you know, you're pushing more and more data to and from it. When was the first time you guys decided you really needed an asset management system or something to keep all your footage organized that wasn't just a folder system?
Well, we always had one with Avid because that is, I guess, technically what it is. We didn't use it like it should have been used. So like Interplay was supposed to be this nice big thing that you kind of organize everything, but we actually didn't know the best practice at the time. We were still getting our heads around editing. You know, we were trying to find the difference between AMA and importing and stuff like that. And it was cool just that we could share projects. You know, we could have projects on one computer and we'd open it up in the other side and be like, oh my gosh, I can see a project that, you know, someone else is working on. It was amazing. So we actually didn't log anything. And if you know how Avid kind of stores their media in bins and in projects, it was a mess. Like files duplicated everywhere. Avid doesn't have like a folder structure at the time. You know, it would store all your media in a folder called One. And then once that folder filled up, it would create a folder named Two and then Three. And then you'd have like thousands of these files within that one folder because that's how it stored everything. So once we filled up our Avid and, you know, after so many complications with that system, it was like you had to be a literal rocket scientist to figure out what was going wrong. There were so many issues on, you know, database corruption and Avid web services and how it ties into everything. Like if something didn't work, it took us the better part of a day getting back to editing, just trying to figure out what was going wrong. So it was pretty painful for us. Cause we went from these simple systems that were self-contained on one computer to these complicated shared storage things. And no one kind of knew what to do or how to troubleshoot things. So then comes in expensive service contracts and stuff like that. After a lot of pulling our hair out, we ended up eventually going to Premiere. And that kind of solved things. And we just use our regular shared storage, like you said, as folders. And people would just kind of remember where they stored things. And, you know, it wasn't till, what, 2 or 3 seasons ago that we got an asset manager for Premiere. So that was a pretty big deal for us.
Yeah, I remember when we ended up getting an asset management system, we, at the end of the season, we did these season recap, you know, player highlights to, you know, showcase the players' best plays of the year. And it was like, I was going back and forth with the other videographer that we had. And it's like, hey, you remember, I remember there was a play of such and such player. Do you remember which game that was in? Like, and we had all the folder structure laid out. Like we had all the footage in each game. And I was like, I don't remember what game that was from. So like going back through at the end of a season, trying to pull that footage was the biggest pain point. And that's really what also pushed us into the asset management side of things. So can you just talk a little bit about how you guys log and name clips? And because even in a basic system, this is something that everybody can take and use regardless of whether you're on shared storage or external drives, so that you can find things that you're looking for.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing is logging that footage. And, you know, everyone at one time, like Brock mentioned, when they were on tape, they were pretty good about making that little index file at first, writing what was on certain time codes. So you'd open that tape case, you'd see a list of stuff that was logged on that tape, and you could kind of put it in, go to that time code and, you know, start rolling it in. Well, the problem with digital is like, you could store it on a hard drive and you have no idea where that drive is. So we had one guy, his name is Jim Edessa. He's our game director now. And the database was basically his brain, because he would just remember where anything was. Like, hey, where was this game from March? Oh, that's on, I think that's on our J drive. And then like, oh, where's the J drive? He's like, oh, if you go, you know, he'd remember exactly what shelf it was on and all that other stuff. It was amazing. If that was any of me, Joe, or Terrence at the time, like it'd take us 2 weeks to find that clip, but he remembered exactly where everything was. So it was, I mean, your typical editor that was just remembered every clip he'd ever watched in Rockets history. Pretty amazing. But eventually when you can have multiple years of things online all at your fingertips, you have to log that footage. I remember going to IDEA in Philly and we were able to visit the NFL Network's facility there. And that was like the first taste of what people could do with logging. And my eyes were opened. Basically NFL Films was logging anything that you could think of, they were logging. And they had a room of like 50 people and they were just logging things. Like that was their job. They were all basically interns, a couple full-timers looking over them, but they were logging every clip with like 5 pages of metadata.
Yeah, I think it's funny you mentioned NFL Films, because before I was at the Chiefs, Joe Dane, like the year before, started with CatDV and asset management, all because I think that exact, he went out to visit NFL Films and they were like, oh yeah, we log everything. And it, like you said, for him, it was just like this eye-opening experience of like, oh, this is the way we need to be doing it. And since we were football, they just gave the Chiefs all their terms that they logged with, which are still a little weird because like a high end zone camera, they call top end zone. Like they have weird things that are like totally not broadcast people, you know? And it's like, or they call low end zones pedestal cameras. But yeah, that's interesting you say that, 'cause that's totally what drove the Chiefs to start using media asset management as well.
And it was always a goal for us to get there, but I realize now that the Rockets are never going to get there. So like the things that they were tagging at the time was like how green the grass was. If the grass was, you know,
oh yeah, alive, we never did that.
Or super green.
Well, now you can just fix it in post, right? Just throw in Premiere and adjust the saturation on it.
Yeah. I mean, they literally say what side the sun was on, if the sky was blue, how many logos they saw, everybody in each clip, they would log out. They would log what camera it was, what lens it was, who shot on what camera. And these people would log live to a certain extent. So it's like, if you saw a smudge in footage and that game was still going on, you could literally see in the metadata who was shooting, what their cell phone number was. You could call them at halftime and say, hey, you have a smudge on your lens, fix it. And it could be fixed by like the next quarter. Mind-blowing stuff, in all honesty. And they were logging just to log, like even the most, like the simplest things, like they would do. And that way, when you type into your search, everything you ever wanted kind of just shows up and more. And I just remember them telling a story like, yeah, you know, we even logged some scrub rookie player doing something small mistake or whatever like that. Fast forward, you know, 10 years, you know, that quarterback that someone logged that they had no idea who he was at the time ended up being Tom Brady. And he's, you know, one of the best quarterbacks ever played the game. And now you can have a full piece on Tom Brady because someone started logging that stuff. You know, at the time when Tom Brady first came into the league, they weren't logging it. But if you have 50 people crammed into a room, you end up being able to work backwards to log everything eventually.
Yeah, that metadata is highly important. And depending on what level you go to, I think that's cool. That's the most important part.
I think something that was, you know, instilled in me a little bit when I started the Chiefs was that, you know, you're not just a broadcast or production department. You also have to be a little bit of a historian, right? And you want things to make sense to somebody 10, 15, 20 years down the road who's trying to use your footage and trying to make a piece, you know, and making sure that it's usable in that sense.
Yeah, no, exactly right. I mean, some of us were still kind of old school in thought process. So we still store things in like a typical folder structure. Back in the day, we used to do it by season. We still do it by season, but we used to break it up into like different folders. If it was game ops, if it was community based, if it was a corporate feature, or something like that. So we would basically have one season and then four or five folders in there. But then as there was so much convergence in what we were asked and tasked to do, we wouldn't quite remember where those projects were because we would say, oh, this was a, you know, so-and-so feature, but we couldn't remember if it was a community event or a sponsored feature, or what if it was a sponsored community event that we shot, then what folder does it go into? So we started just throwing we just created one season and threw everything in that folder. And it's a little bit easier for us to manage. But as a department of two or three people, like one season's worth of stuff, we used to have like maybe 30 to 70 shoots that year. And now we have like hundreds of folders, you know, per season, just because we have different people going off to shoot different things at the same time. So we really had to get that system down because some people like using an asset manager, they like going in looking for James Harden, yada, yada, yada. Well, other people like the typical just browsing through folders. So we wanted to make sure that whatever system we used, it'd be compatible for both types of workflows.
I thought something that, again, I take absolutely no credit for this, that Joe Dane did at the Chiefs that worked really well is in CatDV, which was the asset management platform the Chiefs used, they would be able to rename the file with certain metadata fields. So that way, even if somebody wasn't using CatDV in the future, or somebody was just browsing folders, you still had player, play type, result of the play, you know, like it could still be, you know, Jamal Charles, 25 yard rush, touchdown, you know. But I think what you pointed out, the way you talked about it is different than the way, you know, we did it at the Chiefs, which is different than the way it was done at Notre Dame. I think everybody has their system and that's okay. But I think, like you said, the system has to work for you, you know, and make sense to you. I don't think there's a magic bullet, one size fits all when it comes to how you organize or name your media.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, basically game footage is the easiest stuff for us because we don't have to go back and log it. It's logged by whoever's running replay that day. So we can see if it's mm-hmm. like, you know, a block, a steal, a three-pointer, a dunk, etc. It's really tough for us to go back and log individual shoots that we've had. Like a lot of times still to this day, we just try to name the folder, and I'm just glad that pops up in terms of in search functions, because it's excruciatingly hard for us to go back and log each clip at the end of a shoot. So we're happy that at least on game days and play calls and stuff, we get that stuff logged real time.
Yeah, I think that was the biggest mind-blowing thing when we moved to Dreamcatcher at the Chiefs and we started bringing in GSYS data, and all that GSYS data came over in an XML and was able to be put right into the media asset management. And we no longer had to log replay footage. That was like one of the happiest days of my life.
We tried that at the NBA. Because the NBA, we get that data stream socket. The problem mm-hmm. is when you enable it, it actually creates clips. And we basically ran out of Dreamcatcher storage and space.
Yeah.
Like after one game. So we ended up having to go back to doing
it. See, we did end up using it and letting it clip. But like you said, at the end of one game, it'd be about 75% full. So we then had to offload everything immediately after that game to get it ready for the next game. Definitely some drawbacks to it for sure.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting too is that every sport is going to be different too, right? Right. We're talking about basketball here, and Brock, when you were at Notre Dame, you had all sorts of different sports, you know, whether you have 26 different sports you're trying to log a name for, and chances are your keywords are going to be different for all those different sports, depending on whether it's an Olympic sport or football or basketball. They all have different terminology attached to them. So yeah, I think what you guys have been talking about with making sure that you identify the proper keywords is important. Matt, can you talk a little bit more about when you talk about your folder structure and how you guys name it, is there anything like the player's last name absolutely has to be in this if they're on a community shoot, so that if you're looking for footage of them in the community, that's an easier spot for you to search and find that footage, anything along those lines?
Yeah, sure. I guess the way we name our folders is we first start off with the year, and then so all four character spaces. So it would be like 2020. And then if it's like November 15th or November 20th, it'd be 2020-11-05. And then we'd kind of name what that shoot was. And I mean, that's issue number one. And then we'd try to, within that folder, if it was a multi-camera shoot, we would name what camera was in there, and we would name like what the primary camera was. So within that folder, let's say it's, you know, from August 2019, something, we do 2019-08 for August, 05 for the fifth. We'd name it if it was a game or if it was a community event or a corporate sponsor, corporate feature, whatever it is, we'd put that title in there. We go into that directory, and let's say we had like a Canon 5D, R-Red, and a FS7. We'd name it like Cam A would be our primary camera, and we'd name what camera that was. And then the contents of that card would go in there. camera be, we would name kind of what angle that was and the contents and so forth. And I think if you're an individual, just to make things easy, go with some type of RAID, whether it's a GTEC, a QNAP, a Synology, something affordable, like Brock said. Like, you can have a lot of these RAID drives now for easily under $1,000 to have, what, 40, 30, 40 terabytes worth of space on your computer now, because you can get 10 terabyte hard drives pretty cheap, and the typical RAID set is 4 or 5 or even 6 drives now. If you're a small department, I'd definitely start looking into shared storage. Basically, plug one of those into a switch, and then everyone can kind of access that and kind of start small. You know, you don't need a huge budget to make that happen or to make that work. You just have to go 1 year without upgrading your video card. And
yeah, I was going to say, I know it's not like the sexiest thing in the world to be like, ooh, we're going to spend 20 grand on storage and I'd rather spend 20 grand on a camera. It's like, I think everybody would rather spend more money on cameras and lenses, but the storage is so important. I think you have to force yourself, you know, to put it in there and make sure you're covered. Otherwise you're going to be regretting it later.
Yeah, exactly. And have some spare hard drives on site, you know, if you see a little light, you know, pop up on one of those, replace it.
Set up the email notifications if it has it too, you know?
Yeah, that's a sore subject for us, because IT wouldn't give us access to the mail server. So we ended up having to set up our own mail server. Even in our own IT department, we have more storage than the rest of the company combined. And in terms of network speed and backbone, we are faster than the rest of the team combined. So that's when we started bringing everything in-house.
Also become best friends with your IT department if you can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, when I was doing some research over the summer, I think our storage accounts for like 96 or 97% of the total storage IT infrastructure. So yeah, it's important. And if any of those terms don't make sense to you, any of the RAID switches, what Matt's talking about, if you talk to your IT department, they will definitely be able to help you out with that kind of stuff.
If they were smart, they would help you out because they would realize that their budgets would quadruple if they actually took care of you the way you needed to be taken care of. Because most IT, you know, they could probably do the whole organization on flash, but if you do flash drives or, you know, NVMe drives on video, it costs like $1 million. Like, I kid you not, it'd be ridiculous. But I assume like most sports teams, unless you are like, you know, for basketball, like the Warriors or the Miami Heat or something like that, you unfortunately have to work with a budget of some sort. So we're stuck trying to, you know, value engineer the best bang for your buck.
Yeah. And so maybe that's a good place to go, is just highlighting how you can, like, to upper management, if you wanted to get an asset management, like if you ask for a new camera, I think they can see the results of that, right? If you ask for some asset management and back-end infrastructure, they might be questioning what exactly you're going to use it for and the necessity behind it. Let's get into a little bit more about the purpose of how you can leverage this archive and infrastructure to your benefit.
Yeah, I guess in simple, the easiest way, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but like there's a couple key components you need to make this happen. A, you're going to need, you know, computers, whether it's a Mac or a PC or whatever you are. You're going to need a network switch to, you know, so you can all be on the same network. You're going to need to have a storage, like your hard drives, something that is shared storage that you can all access at once. And then your asset manager kind of sits on top. And unless you're Avid, you can basically choose everything else yourself. Like if you wanted Isilon or Quantum or NetApp or Cumulo, whatever it is. You could have whatever storage you want. You set it, you make sure everything is up, everything is working. You create a folder, someone else can kind of see it on the other side. You don't have any write permissions or anything like that if you're coming from Mac and PC. And then you have this asset management system, which is basically just a layer that sits on top of the storage. Almost like your own YouTube, if you will. A lot of them, they have their own GUI or they have their own application, and it just holds the database for all your files. So you can basically type in a keyword and it searches and it pulls up everything you have. So you can search, you know, usually by year, by a player's first name or last name or three-pointer or dunk or touchdown or home run or whatever your keyword is or goal. And it basically pulls up for you, so you don't have to go searching through a million directories.
Yeah, it's really more about efficiency and the things that you want to be efficient in, so that you have more time for creativity and executing your end goal. And I know Brock's mentioned CatDV. There's different MAMs out there. There's EditShare. There's Cantamo. There's Iconic. There's Axel. There's different price. Yeah, there's different reach price engine. Points across the board as well. So if you're thinking it's like a huge cost, they are going to be a cost to get up and running. But the network storage is just as much of the cost there as well.
Well, like Matt said earlier, there's stuff built into like Adobe Prelude is essentially a MAM. You know, it's not the most elegant thing in the world. But there are things you probably already pay for that you can use to manage your assets. It doesn't have to be this big expense. It all depends on what you're looking for and what you're trying to accomplish as an end goal.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And it can be as complicated as you want. There's ways to value engineer all of these things. It just has to make sense for your workflow. You know, some of these they can do archiving for you, which we used to do. We stopped doing just because we've just been able to add more storage to whatever is online, but eventually we are going to have to archive. But that's a whole nother thing that I don't want to get into, but we're going to have to get into in terms of, you know, are you going LTO? Are you going cloud? And then you're going to have to adjust your budgets accordingly.
You know, at Notre Dame, we, you know, obviously it was a new build from the ground up. So you got a little bit of greenfield to play with, but we had inline storage local. We had a extremely large LTO library. And then we also pushed to AWS on the backside of that. And while in my mind, I'm like, oh, that's such a great storage option. You know, LTOs can sit on the shelf forever. AWS is your disaster recovery. Even though we were using the cheapest tier of AWS, their Glacier storage, which basically is extremely cheap to upload and store, the cost comes in when you have to pull it back down, which would usually be covered by insurance if you got flooded, you know, or a natural disaster happened and you lost your footage. After about 2.5 years, the price for our Glacier storage, we just had petabytes up there. Because once something was confirmed to be on LTO and once something was in the cloud and it hadn't been touched for 6 months, we deleted the file off our local storage, right? So our local storage was always revolving and always kind of, for lack of a better word, eating its own tail. But after 2.5 years of shooting 26 sports in ranging resolutions from 1080 to 4K, we got to the point where it was prohibitively expensive to keep it in the cloud. And we had to sit here and think about how that's going to work. And we ended up coming to the conclusion that we felt that our disaster recovery offsite didn't need to be full res. We were going to keep H.264, H.265 proxies in the cloud as disaster recovery, because our thought process was, if we lost everything in natural disaster, including all of our LTO types, we would just be happy to have whatever we could get and they'd still be workable. Now, is that the ideal solution? No, but it was prohibitively expensive just to keep full res, you know, pro res, and in some instances, raw files on an AWS cloud. You know, it's so easy when you see that initial price of Glacier storage just to be like, oh, it's so cheap, we'll just put everything up there. But everything is a lot when you're talking in terms of sports.
And that's so tough when you talk about that, because to store it all up there, it's extremely expensive. And we still battle with that because we've tried Glacier, we've tried Backblaze. So like you said, Glacier, just to go in depth, is really just LTO, but Amazon is doing it for you. So when you ask to pull something back, they call it Glacier because they still have to load the tape, capture it back, and then send it back to you. Whereas if it's typical AWS, then, you know, it's kind of just always online and they're just sending it right back to you in the next hour, versus Glacier would be like the next day, you know? But we have the same thing. Like, we're like, do we really need all of this footage? Do we really need to keep this community shoot that we did where a player didn't show up?
Right.
But people are passing out turkeys for Thanksgiving, or passing out cakes or whatever for Christmas. And like, do we really need to, you know, keep 10 years worth of that stuff? But then you have things like The Last Dance, and, you know, what if some editor didn't back that footage up? What if the league didn't back that footage up and they said, you know what, let's just, you know, keep a proxy of this. And that's where it kind of, we have trouble throwing stuff away. So it's hard. It's hard to juggle what is needed.
It goes back to the historian aspect of it, right? Like, how much of it is a historian and how much do you have to worry about the bottom line? And you know, a lot of times, you know, that's the argument when we argued for more storage at the Chiefs during our CapEx cycle that we made to the president and the vice president was that historian argument that if we don't do this, we're going to lose part of the Chiefs' history. And I'm not saying be over dramatic about it. We weren't over dramatic about it. We were just realistic about it and had our data straight and our facts and showed that we were at 95% capacity or whatever it is, you know, with a single LTO tape machine that we were manually backing LTO up to, inserting, ejecting. Whereas a lot of bigger LTO archives are automated and have robots that'll put tapes in and out for you, and you can do 20 or 30 or 40, or in the case of Notre Dame, 500 at a time. But I think it's a balance, and I think it's a hard balance that a lot of departments, especially departments now facing budget cuts, it's going to be real easy to cut storage, you know? But to me personally, I think I'd cut about everything else outside of personnel and storage. Just me personally.
Totally agree. I think you'd be hard pressed to find anybody who's in the MAM business or who works with a MAM and storage that isn't a closet hoarder for that kind of content. Because one of the arguments that I've made is, you know, we put in the effort for the shoots. We've say when we drafted Jason Tatum, we followed him. We went to the airport, got his arrival. You know, he's pulling his bags off the wheel and pulling them out and going and getting in the bus and arriving at the Auerbach Center and all that stuff. And 10 years, 20 years down the line, if his number ends up getting retired, that's exactly the content that you're going to want. And you have to be able to go back and find that content when you need it down the line. So I also think that the highlighting the difference between, like, when we're talking about the hot storage tapes, talking about how he's been able to expand his storage on site. So that's your hot swapping storage that you have access to 100% of the time, which is called online storage, right? And then what's the benefit of throwing to Glacier or throwing to LTO tape? And it really comes down to budget, right? Because it's cost. LTO tapes are much cheaper than live storage. And at this point, cloud storage, just because of the cost to get in and out, the egress charges of pulling content back.
Yeah. I mean, the problem at the Rockets is we ran out of space, physical storage space, physical rack space. And, you know, we've, not going to lie, we've lost LTO tapes before. Like, we don't know they're supposed to be on this shelf and they're not. We've had the arms eat LTO tapes up before, and we're kind of like, man, that there goes a whole archive. Like, this is the only place this footage exists. We didn't do two versions of this LTO tape. So once that tape got eaten, you know, we were like, well, that's gone. We're not going to pay thousands of dollars to get, you know, this one clip back. So there are definitely pros to letting someone else handle that in the cloud. But just like you said, you know, when you're trying to pull back something, I'm just going to say this for example, like Kobe Bryant, when he passed away, the Lakers probably had very little time to create something. Think about how many shoots and how much footage they had of Kobe Bryant. How much easier would it be to just kind of type in Kobe, and then let's say you had some type of system where you could rate if the clip was good or bad. For us, we started off with like 10 stars, and then we realized, oh, we could dumb it down to 3 stars. Like, if this is like an okay shot, a usable shot, or a great shot for an angle. And that's helped us out tremendously, in all honesty. Just simplifying how we tag things and what makes a shot good.
And let's wrap with talking about what other advantages, looking forward to artificial intelligence, machine learning, and how that wave could impact your storage and your metadata and being able to return more searchable fields for the metadata. I think I saw that you had posted something tape where you guys are doing transcriptions of interviews and some of that kind of stuff through AI and machine learning.
Well, yeah, I think Avid was the first one that kind of did it. They just did it on site. I forgot, it was like a plugin or an extra license you had to buy in the past. But it did it using your own compute power. And now, like, there's a ton of services online where you just upload a clip and they will transcribe it for you. There's like a dime a dozen at this point. Sorry, I'm right by the freeway and like a ambulance just went by. Anyways, and it makes life a lot easier if you're just trying to do text to speech or something like that. But then you throw in AI and facial recognition. Soon people aren't going to have to tag anything. Once it's there, like the internet will take care of everything for you, which sounds great. But we'll see how accurate it is and how much that costs to keep that up and running.
When I was at Notre Dame, I sat and saw a demo. I don't remember if it was AWS directly or some company, you know, working on AWS's platform, but they took our football footage and pulled numbers from it and then just pulled a roster table. Where it broke down a little bit in college football was that it couldn't tell who was on offense or defense, and you have the same number on each side of the ball a lot of times in college football because there's so many players. But my mind was still blown. I have no idea what it costs. We didn't even get that far. But I think you're right. It's going to get there. It's not a matter of if, but when, and when is it going to be affordable?
Yeah. And that's where the NBA is kind of lucky. We have like Second Spectrum. It used to be Stats Inc, but they log a lot of stuff for you as well. So if you're able to get that information, they tell you, you know, how fast the player ran and how long they ran and how high they jumped and all that other good stuff. And they tie it to, you know, plays, how many times did James Harden dribble or pass the ball? And they tie it to a time in the game that you can kind of go back to. So I think we'll see how everyone starts capturing this stuff, but if we can make it simple and easy, that's priority number one. But then what's the cost behind all this stuff? And are you actually going to use it in post? So it's interesting.
Yeah. Between AWS, Gray Meta, Veritone, there's definitely a couple of companies out there that are making some good headway with different speech to text, facial recognition, OCR, number recognition, and being able to read even old text files. I think it's really cool. And the opportunities are exciting just because I think especially for us who all grew up in the tape ages and just seeing where things have evolved to and what you can do digitally. Yes, there's some headaches and different ways of making sure that you have what you need when you need it and cutting down some of that time. But yeah, really excited with where things are going. So thanks for joining us, Tape, and giving us insight into your process and how you guys go about this, because I think it's definitely a need for people across all levels of no matter where they are in their video production, capturing, editing phase of their career, or what school they're at, or what team they work for. It's becoming more important as we go.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to close, the biggest thing that I want people to understand is just because you have an asset manager doesn't mean that everything's going to be organized. You're going to have to take a conscious effort to do it or to staff it to make sure someone or everyone, like a group effort, to make sure everyone is following the rules and putting things where it needs to go, or else you're just going to have it could be chaos, you know. At the Rockets, we don't have an asset manager, so it's kind of up to everybody to put stuff in a logical place for someone else to find it. And we're finding, you know, pressure points all the time. So we're constantly updating and thinking about ways we can streamline things. But if you're able to hire an asset manager and make it their job, you know, to make sure that everything is organized.
All right, that wraps up another episode. So we'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions. So pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives there. The quickest way to get us to stop this podcast is to not tell anyone about it. So leave us your 5-star rating and don't forget to subscribe so you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.